Hello there. Today is Thursday, January 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump says he's open to talks and takes credit for meetings between the Koreas.
We'll see where it goes. He's very thankful for what we've done. It was so reported today.
The president not saying he's open to talking to the special counsel investigating Russia election meddling. The world's largest consumer electronics show is underway in Las Vegas with some gadgets you just won't believe are real.
Who knows if they're going to buy it, but they're going to talk about it.
Also ahead, it's award season and we have two fresh movie reviews. Well, President Trump met with Norwegian Prime Minister Erna Solberg Wednesday, followed by a news conference.
We've just concluded a series of discussions on how we can work together to promote a future of security and world prosperity, and also a great future for our respective countries working together. The Prime Minister and I are both committed to strengthening the NATO alliance. Norway has made contributions to the NATO-led mission in Afghanistan, where we are doing very well. It's been turned around.
A reporter asked Trump if he's willing to meet with and be interviewed by special counsel Robert Mueller about the investigation into allegations that Trump's presidential campaign had ties with Russia.
I can only say this. There was absolutely no collusion. Everybody knows it. Every committee. I've been in office now for 11 months. For 11 months, they've had this phony cloud over this administration, over our government. And it has hurt our government. It does hurt our government. It's a Democrat hoax that was brought up as an excuse for losing an election that, frankly, the Democrats should have won because they have such a tremendous advantage in the Electoral College. So it was brought up for that reason. But it has been determined that there is no collusion, and by virtually everybody. So we'll see what happens.
But again, would you be open to it?
We'll see what happens. I mean, certainly I'll see what happens. But when they have no collusion and nobody's found any collusion at any level, it seems unlikely that you'd even have an interview.
Mueller has reportedly indicated to Trump's attorneys, apparently, that his team would like to interview the president as part of the investigation. So far, the investigation has resulted in the indictment of former campaign chair Paul Manafort and a guilty plea from former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn. Mueller's team has interviewed a number of Trump aides, including Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner and former chief of staff Rince Priebus. Earlier Wednesday, Trump called the investigation the single greatest witch hunt in American history. Well, before meeting with the Norwegian Prime Minister, President Trump had a phone conversation with South Korean President Moon Jae-in on Wednesday. He expressed his openness to holding talks between the United States and North Korea at the appropriate time under the right circumstances.
I just spoke to President Moon. He's very thankful for what we've done. They're having talks with North Korea. We'll see how that happens. He felt that the initial talk was extremely good, had a lot of good comment. Rex was on the phone, and Nikki's been totally briefed, but we had a very, very good conversation, and we'll see where it goes. He's very thankful for what we've done. It was so reported today that we were the ones without our attitude that would have never happened. Who knows where it leads? Hopefully it'll lead to success for the world. Not just for our country, but for the world. And we'll be seeing over the next number of weeks and months what happens.
Well, according to a readout of the call issued by the White House, the two leaders underscored the importance of continuing the maximum pressure campaign against North Korea. President Moon's office first reported the conversation, which came a day after North and South Korea held their first high-level talks in more than 2 years. Joining us now to discuss is James Person, Director for Research at the U.S.-Korea Institute. What do you think of the sudden willingness of North Korea to speak to its neighbor to the South after all this estrangement and saber-rattling?
This certainly isn't the first time. North Korea has reached out to South Korea after periods of tension. This one comes as the United States and North Korea have been ratcheting up the pressure on one another. And after a period of intense sanctions against North Korea and an increasing number of sanctions, that according to North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, who delivered a speech on New Year's Day, have actually started to have an impact on life in North Korea. And so it's not a complete surprise that he would try to reach out to South Korea to reduce tensions.
Why now?
Well, now because sanctions may be biting just a little bit more and not going to lead to anything but a temporary relaxation of some sanctions. Now, because perhaps they feel confident, having demonstrated at least the ability to hedge on a successful program that could, in theory, strike the U.S. homeland, although that we cannot say with all certainty that that fact is possible, but they have the ability to hedge,
right,
having tested successfully an ICBM. Now,
right,
the question is, do they have the ability to marry that, or a warhead, a miniaturized warhead, onto that ICBM? And then can that warhead survive reentry into the atmosphere? That's the question. And that's something we hope we never find out.
Right, of course. Well, North Korea did say its nuclear targets are all aimed at the U.S. mainland. So is that just more posturing and rhetoric, or it sounds worrisome?
There are really two lines of thinking on what the North Koreans want with this nuclear weapons program. There are some who believe that the North Koreans are going to use this as a shield behind which they hope to reunify the Korean Peninsula. Others who believe, and I'd fall more on this side, who believe that there's more of a credible defensive rationale to the program. And having studied North Korea's history for decades now, I can see that there is some credibility to this, to their desire to have, at least to their mind, this defensive rationale.
Right.
They want to have this program because they think that they've been living under the shadow of nuclear threat for decades, and they have learned lessons from the experiences of other authoritarian leaders who either had unrealized nuclear weapons programs or who voluntarily abandoned their weapons programs only for those regimes to be toppled. And here, I'm talking about Iraq and then Libya. So for North Koreans, there is this defensive rationale toward the United States because they fear that the United States ultimately seeks to overthrow their regime.
President Trump seems to be taking some responsibility for these talks between the North and the South, citing his peace through strength approach. We all know he's famous for the tweets. Do you agree President Trump deserves credit for the North and South talks?
I don't know that he deserves credit. I tend to see this more in the context of patterns in inter-Korean relations, where, again, you've had periods of rhetoric, of hostility, followed by periods of rapprochement, however short-lived. And I see it within this broader pattern.
The U.S. insists the only option is for North Korea to abandon its nuclear program. North Korea says it will never do that. So what's the answer? Does that mean a war has to be inevitable, or what's the solution here?
Well, I don't think war is inevitable. The United States has lived in the shadow of nuclear threat for over six decades now. We've lived first with the Soviet Union having a nuclear weapons program and an ICBM program. We've lived since the mid-1960s with China having a nuclear weapons program and the ability to strike the U.S. homeland. North Korea ultimately is deterrable, just like Russia or the Soviet Union and now Russia and China. And they are rational. They are predictable. We will be able to deter. We will be able to live with a nuclear North Korea. As distasteful as it is, and we don't deal well with threat, we will be able to live with them. I don't think it means we're going to have to go to war with North Korea. But at the same time, I also understand that it is highly unlikely that North Korea, having worked on this program for really since the early 1960s and to have gotten so close, it's inconceivable to me that they will walk away from the program at any point in the near future. But it's not something that we haven't dealt with before. We have lived under the shadow of nuclear threat, going back to the Soviet detonation of their first bomb. And we've been able to deter both Russia and, since the mid-60s, China. So it's not something that we haven't dealt with before. And North Korea, just like the Soviet Union and now Russia and China, is deterrable. North Korea is not irrational, not unpredictable. We can deter North Korea the same way that we did Russia and China.
All right. That's James Person, Director for Research at the U.S. Korea Institute. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Indonesia moves forward on plans to relocate its capital. No official confirmation from Pakistan on suspension of cooperation with the U.S. Myanmar's military admits to killing 10 Rohingya found in a mass grave. And Russia's troop withdrawal from Syria will not shorten its clout, according to experts. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a resolution Tuesday condemning Iran's leadership for crackdowns on recent protests. The vote comes just days ahead of the beginning of a 60-day window for Congress to address President Trump's decision to not recertify the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. VOA's congressional reporter Catherine Gibson has more on Capitol Hill's political debate over Iran.
The protests have subsided, but the people of Iran have not been forgotten. That is the message from the U.S. Congress as House lawmakers condemn the regime's crackdown on demonstrators.
We cannot be quiet. With the passage of this resolution, we state that America stands with the Iranian people.
A point Iranian leadership disputed just hours before that vote. Ayatollah Khamenei tweeting, "Iran knows its own people better than the U.S. and President Trump," who tweeted throughout the protests. But lawmakers say that is not the intent of the House resolution or a similar resolution soon to come up for a vote in the U.S. Senate.
In standing with the Iranian people, we must explain that they are not the target of our sanctions. U.S. sanctions target the oppressive, destabilizing regime, not the people of Iran.
The vote comes at a key point. President Trump threw the 2015 nuclear deal negotiated by the Obama administration into doubt in October when he declined to recertify Iranian compliance, pushing for new terms.
This president, this administration are absolutely committed to continue to bring the full economic weight of the United States and these economic sanctions to bear on Iran. Now, we're also working with the Congress to arrive at a new agreement and a new set of conditions for sanctions going forward.
The protests only increasing the urgent need for a decision on the deal as the window for a congressional response opened this week.
I've been meeting with the representatives of the Trump administration in regards to the certification and waiver issues as to how Congress can be helpful, provided that we don't do anything that would violate the nuclear agreement and that we work closely with our European partners.
And even while it appears the protests have dwindled, one analyst says their impact will linger.
There will have a lasting effect in that the regime can no longer be certain that the heartland on which it used to count is solidly behind it.
Giving lawmakers even more reason to find areas for agreement.
In this House, we are on both sides of the Iran nuclear deal, but we were united in knowing that Iran is not an ally of the United States, at least the Islamic Republic of Iran is not, and this House never agreed to ignore extreme human rights abuses simply because the government of Iran has agreed to limitations on its nuclear program.
The window for congressional action on those limitations closes in March. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
The VOA's International Edition continues. The Consumer Electronics Show is in full swing this week in Las Vegas, and companies are showing off their latest gadgets amid a crush of visitors. Joining us now from Las Vegas is Fortune contributing writer Chris Morris, who's been checking out all the goodies. And Chris, you are at the world's largest electronics show, and I understand they ran into a little glitch that wouldn't be so bad, except it's the world's largest electronics show.
Yeah, we had a little power outage here today at the Las Vegas Convention Center. Actually, it wasn't a little one. It was a two-hour-long outage, and it was affected the central hall. Now, I'm not sure if you've been to Las Vegas before. The convention center is made up of three enormous halls. But the center hall for CES is the heart of the show. It's where all the new TVs are shown off. It's where the really blockbuster things are up for display. So with that out of the running, it really was sort of a black eye for the show.
I would say so. My goodness. So it's all good now?
It's all good now. It took a couple hours to get it fixed, like I said. The reason that it happened is there were real heavy rains here yesterday. There's actually some flooding in the parking garages. And they say that some of the condensation from that rain caused some problems with the transformers and they blew.
That's incredible. All right. Well, glad things are back on track. I know there's lots going on and there's so many things to look at. What are some of the main themes you're seeing?
You know, the big themes that I'm seeing this year is artificial intelligence and voice assistants. And in the real world terms, that's things like Google Voice. It's things like Alexa. All of the companies here, or at least the large majority of the companies, are looking to make your appliances, your television, all these things you interact with on a day-to-day basis, more intelligent so they can anticipate your needs and help you out.
Cool. Like lots of smart stuff.
Lots of smart stuff. And Samsung is really trying to tie everything together. Now, they make televisions, of course. They make refrigerators. They're working in smart vehicles now. And they're getting it so that all of these devices work together in a single harmonious unit. So essentially, your TV can be a central hub where you can see through your smart doorbell who's at your front door. You can see that your baby is waking up from its nap because you have a smart baby monitor in there. You can check to see if you have any leftover beer or wine in your fridge before you walk over there to grab it.
Wow. Incredible. Pretty soon we won't need humans for anything, really.
You know, we're pretty much getting a little outdated right now, I think, yeah.
Absolutely. And I know TVs are always big. The next big amazing screen, or what's going on with TVs?
You know, TVs are the sexiest thing at CES every year, and this year is no exception. Samsung unveiled a 140-inch screen called The Wall. Now, not only is that just giant, so big you'll need a different living room before you ever wanted to get it. It has what's called a micro LED screen, and that's sort of an in the weeds term, but it means really dark blacks and really bright colors. And what's really cool about this TV is it's modular, which means that you can make it bigger or smaller just by adding on to the outside of it. So it's a new way to make televisions. You don't really see the seams when you add these different modules on there. That's pretty neat. Now, meanwhile, LG, their competitor, is introducing an 8K OLED set. Now, that has that same dark blacks and really bright colors, but 8K is 8 times as clear as high definition.
Before I let you go, I mean, it's the gadget show. There's all kinds of crazy stuff. What's the weirdest thing you've seen?
Well, you know, I was saying that everything's going to get more intelligent. I think the weirdest thing this year would be from Kohler, which is a talking toilet.
What?
Yes, I'm not kidding. It's a toilet that connects to the internet and it responds to
voice
commands.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, it's hard to top that.
Okay. Are people going to buy that?
Oh, who knows if they're going to buy it, but they're going to talk about it. And that's what Kohler wants.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. All right, that's Fortune contributing writer Chris Morris. And we're turning now to what's trending on social media, and for that, we hear from VOA's Doug Bernard.
So, the other day I ran across this quote, which I've seen before, by Warren Buffett, the billionaire investor. Somebody had once asked Mr. Buffett, what was his secret to success? And he was a very modest man, and he was in his office, and he turned around and pointed at the bookshelf, and he said, read 500 pages every day. That's how knowledge works. It builds up like compound interest. All of you can do it, but I guarantee not many of you will. Now, when I remember I read that now and I think 500 pages every day, that's just sort of, you know, unreasonable, and there's no way that that's going to happen. But I started sort of breaking down, you know, the time and just kind of poking around a little bit. There's a survey that was published recently by Pew that finds that the average American spends over 600 hours a year just on social media, and over 1,600 hours just watching television. Now, if you think about how many times you might be just flipping through Twitter or Facebook, and, you know, you're really not even there. You're just sort of, you know, flipping pages up and up and up in indefinite scrolling. That time tends to add up. And when you sit down and you figure, well, the average reading speed and, you know, average book length and that kind of thing, if you were, say, you wanted to read, say, maybe about 200 books a year, that would come out to, by my calculations, about 400 hours a year spent reading. So that's even less than people just spend Twittering around or, you know, Facebooking. So it's doable. Again, not many people are likely to do it, but it's just one of those things to think about when you find yourself spending time. These are all decisions that we make, and, you know, we can choose to spend our time doing what we want to do, not just what comes easily.
All right, Doug. Good thoughts. Good food for thought. VOA's Doug Bernard. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, it's awards season, as the biggest films of 2017 are in very good company with a lot of really great performances last year. Joining us now for reviews of a couple of them is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. So, hey, Jeff, let's start with the drama thriller The Commuter. You've seen it. What do you think?
Not only is it awards season, it's a classic dumping ground for lesser films, if I can put it as politely as possible. But yes, of course, we have Liam Neeson, who's back, doing what he does best. He's our action hero. For some reason, I'm romantic about thrillers or things that happen on a train. Being from the West, you know, we have the trains that are no longer used, you know, like those big iron horses. But these are all more commuter trains. I thought this is going to be interesting to see how he solves this mystery that's on this commuter train. So he's an insurance salesman. Liam Neeson plays a 60-year-old who's been fired, and he's actually 65 in real life. So he's coming home. He's got two mortgages. He's got a kid going to college. He can't tell his wife, when a mysterious stranger approaches him and says, look, I starts doing a psychological kind of what-if game with him. And then when she explains, you know, there's someone on his train, and if you had no connection to him and you wanted $100,000, would you do X? I'm not going to give away what she wants. And, of course, he thinks, well, this is all hypothetical. When she says, no, it's real. And you're going to do this, or there's going to be consequences, and you have 4 to 6 stops before the last stop where this person's going to get off that you must identify and do the task we are telling you to do, or you're going to die, your family will die, everyone on the train will die. So now for the next hour and a half, he is also an ex-cop. So he's using his mental facilities and using all his knowledge and willpower to figure out this specific person they want stopped getting off of that train. And so... what's funny is that, of course, he's going to try to contact the police. He's going to try to give notes to people to get off the train. And it's not the best film in the world. It's definitely a B film. But you know what? We just love watching Liam Neeson kick some butt, you know?
That's
we love
cool.
to see him punch people and get the bad guys. You know, he's just this action hero that we love to cheer. And I have to admit, it does get pretty exciting because it's very Hitchcock. You're trying to figure out this mystery with him. You're trying to use your wits and everything. So I think this is a great action film that's going to kick off the year with Liam Neeson.
Well, the Post. I'm excited to see this one. Anything with Meryl Streep is going to be good. And then add Tom Hanks to the mix. Going to be good. It's a story about a newspaper, journalist, no-brainer.
It's a trifecta. You forgot the biggest name of all, Steven Spielberg.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, so he directed it. Right? And, you know, when I was a little boy, I used to see, like, the Saturday matinees and see, you know, the Disney films and Godzilla films and cartoons. But always I would stay sometime, you know, seeing movies all day. I would see the main feature the theater was playing. And I remember being 10 years old seeing All the President's Men. And for some reason, that movie struck me. I didn't understand it, but I used to see it over and over and over. My parents were staunch Republicans. They couldn't figure out what this 10-year-old was doing. And I met Dustin Hoffman years later, and I told him that was the movie that gave me my political voice. And just like the Nixon era and with Watergate, where Nixon attacked the press, this is the same story where Nixon attacked the Pentagon Papers and the Washington Post, with threatening the editor and threatening the publisher with jail time. And so the movie's very current because, of course, the Trump administration is well known for attacking the working press, you know, the First Amendment. And so this movie's very poignant. It's all happening all over again. And what's really unique about the Post is it's about a three-decade cover-up of the Pentagon Papers. They knew, the federal government knew that the war was a failure. Okay, so, but now here's the thing. Do you publish these papers, which is essentially illegal, you know, they're classified, or do you go to jail and stand by your principles? And also, the New York Times was publishing it, so the Washington Post wanted to beat them to the punch, or at least get on the same footing and also, you know, defend the First Amendment.
So, overall, did you love it? Did you like it? What'd you think?
Well, I thought it was brilliant. You know, it's not the kind of movie that people expect from Steven Spielberg, meaning, you know, it's not a thriller. It's very wordy. It's very intellectual. But if it's that's your kind of movie, if you love this country and you love politics, you love journalism, the movie is perfectly portrayed by Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks playing Bed Bradley, and also she's playing the publisher. She's phenomenal. There's great stories coming out of the making of the film, how, you know, Meryl Streep loves to rehearse and Spielberg doesn't. So she shows up on the set and, you know, Hanks knew what she was in for, but it all worked out. And also Spielberg is really making movies of late about our freedoms, about how they're under attack. He's really taken to the big screen to show, look, what's happened in the past is happening again, and you've got to make sure your rights are protected. Freedom of speech, freedom of press, press that calls the government into action, that keeps track on them. It's one of the best films of last year. The Post is phenomenal.
That was Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Journalism remains a dangerous profession in too many places around the world. On October 16th, Daphne Caruana Galizia, a journalist reporting on corruption in Malta as part of the Panama Papers investigation, was killed by a car bomb. In September, attackers set fire to the car of Yulia Latinina, a columnist for Novaya Gazeta and host of a weekly radio show in Russia. Protecting journalists and media practitioners against violence from those who may want to censor them is a core tenet of freedom of expression, said Shannon McGuire, a media advisor with USAID's Bureau for Europe and Eurasia, promoting independent media development. Since 1992, more than 800 journalists have been murdered around the world, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ. Of those cases, 86% were killed with impunity, meaning no one has been held responsible. In Russia, which ranks in the top 10 of CPJ's list, the attack on Latinina was just the latest in a series of assaults and threats against Russian journalists and opposition figures that have not resulted in formal charges. In Ukraine, the murder of prominent investigative journalist Pavel Sheremet also remains unsolved more than a year later. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has prioritized support to independent media in Europe and Eurasia since beginning work there in 1992. Its programs focus both on the supply and demand sides of news and information, as well as advocating for greater press freedom. One such program is the Regional Investigative Journalism Network, which helps shield reporters from attack by making it more difficult for criminals to pinpoint those who have exposed their wrongdoings. In Ukraine, USAID's U-Media project has collaborated with more than 500 independent media outlets to ensure that professional journalists operate safely and protect their data in conflict areas in eastern Ukraine and Crimea while they report on the fighting and Russian occupation. Donors, policymakers, advocacy organizations, and civil society organizations must continue to exert pressure on those involved in censorship to ensure the continuation of open, public debate and the free flow of information. Journalists are not soldiers, and their cameras and pens are not weapons, said Ms. McGuire. They shouldn't need to fear the phrase, "Don't kill the messenger."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
from Washington.